just our little carpet. Wow, that song has some beautiful notes to it. I wish I could have found at least one of them. We may need to practice that one a bit. That's going all over. I don't know about you. I was going all over the place on that one. It was like all over the parking lot musically, but my apologies to Becky Rigdon, who wrote it. I'm sure she would be cringing if she heard me sing that song. Oh, my. Well, due to the most recent events, I kind of scrapped the idea that I had and moved on to a different and more topical subject last night, as soon as we had a chance to kind of debrief ourselves over these horrible terrorist attacks in France. And it raised the question, why France? And you probably wondered that yourself, why France? And I'll try to answer that and other questions during the sermon today. Certainly one of the things that comes up is the clash of cultures that have taken place. Now, I studied France quite a bit when I was in Europe, or at least the history of France, the geography of France has some interesting, there are some interesting prophecies regarding France in the Bible, not many of them, of which I will explain a little bit later as to why. But the history of religion in our country is far different than the history of religion in France, as you might guess. France became a nation that was basically Catholic. It was a nation that at one time housed the papacy. It had the summer home of the Pope, and that is where the very famous wine, usually people remember French for their wine, but Châteauneuf du Pape is the wine, a very famous wine from a famous region of France, where the popes had the summer home. So it's near the house of the Pope, and that is why it is called Châteauneuf du Pape. So it's a very good wine, it's a very good red wine. I'm not saying that every vintage is going to be good, and just looking for that particular name in your favorite wine retailer may not necessarily guarantee it, but if you ask for advice, I'm sure you'll get a very good Châteauneuf du Pape. But our history is one that we are very familiar with in terms of religious freedom. In the United States, many of our early immigrants in the 16th and the 17th century, the 18th century, came to the United States for freedom of expression in terms of their religion. And even though they were Christian, they were a different type of Christianity, a slightly different belief of Christianity than, let's say, the Anglican Church, for which they were persecuted, and people were persecuted for their religious beliefs. It's never been that way with France, because Christianity in France has basically been Catholicism. And I don't know the exact percentage of Catholicism in France. There are certainly other aspects of it, but basically it's predominantly Catholic. But we do have a clash of cultures, and that clash of cultures began in the 600s AD when the Muslims invaded France, and they were finally expelled at the Battle of Tours in 632, and then finally expelled from all of Europe at a much later time. Probably it took about 800 or 900 years more to get all of the Muslims out of and expelled from Spain and all the rest of Europe. But today, that is totally different. What does the future hold for the French people? And is there anything in the Bible that we can look to that helps us gain an idea of that? First of all, I'd like to direct your attention to Revelation chapter 2 and Revelation 3, which details the admonishments and the letters that went out to churches that were in Asia Minor, which is Turkey today, in the first century AD from the Apostle John. And in each of these locations, there were certain proclivities and there were certain things that were happening that the brethren of the Church of God in the first century had to be warned about, or approaching the first century had to be warned about. There were certain attitudes that took place. Even as you know, in traveling around to various churches, not that you have an attitude or anything else, but just like when we were transferred here, for instance, to Tucson, Arizona, it was more of a melting pot of peoples because Tucson is somewhat transient, and the congregation reflected that, and it reflected a lot more diversity, so in many ways. In South Dakota, where we lived and where we had lived for 9 years, it was basically a very homogeneous type of group, and the people that were in the church were reflected of the society around them, which Mr. Anderson was on the Eastern Nebraska, so he would be familiar with the type of people in South Dakota because he was just one state away. But even the people of East Nebraska and East South Dakota, that's where you're from, and they're different from the people, a little bit different than the people of Western South Dakota and Western Nebraska. A lot of them are simply pioneers. And so there are different attitudes that were prevalent there. And the people in South Dakota that we were with were really tough people. I mean, they were the sons and the daughters of a land that had been pioneered only in like the 1800s. And so they only went back a couple of generations. And if you moved to South Dakota in 1830 or Nebraska, you had to be really, really tough to survive if you were a homesteader, and many of them were. And so we just found that there was tremendous differences in the attitudes, and we contrast that with living in Austin, Texas, kind of a smaller metropolitan area where we had lived before, and Corpus Christi where we had lived before. There are differences in parts of the country. There are differences in parts of the world. And so John is writing to these folks who lived in different locales, and there were different attitudes that were prevalent. We also have always taught, I still believe this, and it's not a matter of doctrine necessarily that you have to believe this, but we believe that these areas in which Paul wrote to were also symbolic of different attitudes of the church throughout the ages. In other words, there would be a predominant attitude for maybe several hundred years, and then that era would end. So the Ephesus era was an era that is admonished for leaving their first love. Ephesus was kind of the central church, eventually became the central church after Jerusalem, and so it is looked upon as the Ephesian era of the Church of God. And that's where a lot of the ministry sprung from. Paul went there, and others were developed within the ministry and sent out. Also, of course, earlier than that, from Jerusalem. But we go all the way and trace our history as a nation to the migration of people that came from Europe, and specifically the United Kingdom at first, and then from in the 1900s, the early 1900s, from a lot of different places, as we know, from Ireland and from Scotland, where my parents came from, and then from also Italy and a lot of other places of Europe. But basically, to begin with, much of it was from the United Kingdom, and it was from England, and it was from that point that there was an individual who was a Seventh-day Baptist. And Seventh-day Baptists, because they disagreed with the Anglican Church, were not looked highly upon, and they had to practice and keep their faith in secret. But in the 1600s, Stephen Mumford led a group of these Seventh-day Baptists that we regard as people of the Church of God to Rhode Island, and they set up shop there. And we trace kind of some of our historical antecedents as a Church of God today back to those times. Now, this church is mentioned, I believe this church is mentioned at the beginning of chapter 3. And I don't know exactly how long it existed, but it existed certainly in that time in the 1600s in England when those folks began to appear and they began to practice their beliefs. But they could not, because they were more and more numerous and they were being ostracized and they were being encouraged to leave, and they had to flee in order to be able to practice their beliefs. And that was not unusual in England, because at that time, England was not a very welcoming society in terms of other faiths. If you were not in the Anglican Church, then you were not under the auspices of God or the king, because it was God, the king, who was the ruler of the Anglican Church, because, of course, they had broken away from the time of Mary, Queen of Scots in 1580, and her demise. They had broken away from the Catholic Church, and they became a Protestant nation at that particular point. So the Protestants were almost as intolerant of other religions as the Catholics were in other parts of Western Europe. It says of this church, to the angel of the church of Sardis write, these things says he who has the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. I know your works, that you have a name, that you are alive, but you are dead. Be watchful and strengthen the things which remain that are ready to die, for I have not found your works perfect before God. So Stephen Mumford and his followers kept the Sabbath, and they kept it very nicely. And we have a record of their activities from Rhode Island on. And it is this group of people that eventually, a segment of this group of people that Herbert Armstrong came in contact with so that he could learn about the Sabbath day. Now, he learned also during the course of his studies, beginning in the late 1920s, he also learned as he studied Leviticus 23 and other chapters, he understood that the Sabbath needed to be kept after he had first refuted his wife's admonishment to keep the Sabbath. Finally studied into it, and he found out that she was right and he was wrong, and he had admitted that he was wrong. But along the way, he also found out that if you're going to keep the Sabbath day, the Sabbath is also mentioned along with all the rest of the holy days in Leviticus 23. And the same accommodation must be made for those days if you're going to obey God. And he took that commandment very, very seriously. And he tried to present that information as you would with information that he had also studied and understood. Some call it British Israelism. We'll get into a little bit of that today in conjunction with the study of France. Some would call it that. It's an idea or philosophy or a teaching that dates back to the 1800s by the British Israel Society, who of themselves, there may have been some members of the Church of God, because England by that time had become a little bit more tolerant of other religions. After they got rid of us, they became more tolerant of what was going on in their own society. That was just the nature of things and how it went. So Mr. Armstrong understood about Israel, and he understood about the sons of Jacob, and he understood about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the blessings, and all of that sort of thing that were passed down from generation to generation to generation. And so he understood that, and he tried to present that material. He did present that material in 1937 to a Detroit conference of the Church of God. And the information on the holy days and the information on who Israel is today, present, circa 1930, and who are these peoples of Genesis 49 and Deuteronomy 33, and specifically the people of Ephraim and Manasseh, was rejected wholesale. And the elders at that time dismissed all of that teaching because they grouped it into the same body of work that was evaluated in Acts 15, whereas the Gentiles were not required to circumcise themselves and do other things. Now, you can see no mention of holy days or anything like that mentioned in Acts 15, but they grouped the holy days along with everything else that the Gentiles weren't required to do, so that's what they teach today. The Bible Advocate has been at times a very good publication, sometimes with some very gifted writing. The forerunner of the Bible Advocate was going and was in publication in an earlier part of the 20th century, and I learned about this from Mr. Tannert, and I gave a sermon about J.J. Rupert, or at least included his information, because he discovered and learned and understood basically everything, these basic tenets: United States of Britain in prophecy, and the holy days, which I think are kind of both linchpins in really understanding Bible prophecy. Not that you can't attain salvation without that knowledge, because obviously the Sardis church is going to be saved, and the people of Sardis are going to be saved by God. However, their faith is not perfected if they don't have that, and it was tried twice, because G.G. Rupert from Oklahoma a minister of the Church of God and his little flock, understood this information, wrote extensively about it, wrote incredible work that parallels that same understanding that God would reveal later on to Herbert Armstrong, and it was incredible how closely aligned it is. Some people feel that Mr. Armstrong may have borrowed liberally from him. We don't know, and there's no evidence, but we do have this in history. We have a bridge between G.G. Rupert and Herbert Armstrong, and that bridge is comprised of two ministers by the name of Duggar and Dodd, and they wrote, and you can look this up, they wrote a book entitled A True History of the Church, or A History of the True Church. It's escaping me. I'm just kind of ad-libbing right now anyway. So, but they were the bridge, and especially Dodd, who was the editor of the predecessor, I believe, to the Bible Advocate in the times before 1920. And they allowed G.G. Rupert to write in that publication and to publish these ideas. And G.G. Rupert independently published his ideas as well. Basically, what we know today is that this aspect of the Church of God, who will walk in white, who will be in the first resurrection, did not have that information, either because their elders rejected it, they had it presented to them. And so we find that it says in verse 3, "Therefore, remember how you have received and heard, hold fast and repent. Therefore, if you will not watch, I will come upon you as a thief, and you will not know what hour I will come upon you." There are still vestiges of the Church of God Seventh Day, which used to be headquartered in Stanbury, Missouri, now in Denver, Colorado. There are still vestiges of that church, and the Bible Advocate still is in print today. "You have a few names, even in Sardis, who have not defiled their garments, and they shall walk with me, for they are worthy. He who overcomes shall be clothed in white garments, and I will not blot out his name from the book of life, but I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels." Those people have existed. In some ways, some segments of the Church of God may have migrated through the Swiss Alps and through France and eventually on into the United Kingdom, and then eventually transferred themselves over to this country because of the religious persecution, along with a lot of other faiths, a lot of other Protestant beliefs and faiths that sprung up during the time of the Great Reformation of the 1700s and the 1800s, and so on and so forth. But for France, you have to remember that it was quite different. It used to be the summer house for the popes. It was almost entirely Catholic. Yes, there were some other vestiges of the Reformation which touched some French lives, but one of the things about the French that has been kind of universally practiced in their religion and in their government is that it is highly it is highly organized and centralized. And even though they have had many, many governments since the time of the French Revolution, what they eventually ended up with was a centralized system of government, and it kind of applied to the church as well. And the Catholic Church is dominant. Probably 90% of all Frenchmen would say that they are Catholic. That is their faith. Although, as a faith-born religion, it is not widely practiced. I mean, they have wonderful, beautiful, gorgeous cathedrals and churches, but like much of Europe, religion is in disrepair. It's been overtaken by humanism for 150 years or so. And so it's not as though there aren't French people that go to church and go to their mass, but they're Catholic in name, but it's not really up to us to judge them for how they practice. But we have a clash of cultures which is quite different than the history of the United States, and that is what is taking place in France. And now about 7.5% of the French population is Islamic. They are Muslim. And in many cases, they do not tend to blend in with society, and they are not a part of this centrally governed French government, which has 95, well, we would call them maybe counties or smaller boroughs or whatever. They're not governed in many cases by those. They keep to themselves. They're not even governed by French police or by the social services or anything. They're just enclaves that have been built around in various parts of France. And so it's quite a different society. Let's take a look at what the Bible says about the beginning of France, if you accept it. I mean, I don't necessarily think I'm here to try to prove it to you. You folks basically know it. But what have we taught? And some people believe this. I've never run across anybody that says, that's crazy. I don't believe that at all. But if you go back to Genesis chapter 49, you see the little bit of prophetic utterance of the French people. A small, tiny portion, and there is a reason for that as well, that only a small amount is mentioned about what we think are the French people in terms of prophecy. In Genesis 49, in verse 1, it says that Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather together, that I will tell you what shall befall you in the last days." A prominent clue that this is in the future. Latter days, latter times, last days are prophetic in meaning. "Gather together and hear, you sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel, your father." Jacob, Israel, Joseph, almost always synonymous in Bible prophecy for the reasons elaborated on in the previous chapter, which most of you know, but a quick review if you don't know. Israel, or Jacob, after he wrestled with God, his name was changed from supplanter to overcomer, or he who rules with God as well, as I brought out a few weeks ago in a sermon. Overcomer. He said in Genesis chapter 48 that he was talking to Joseph, the next to the last son that was born of Rachel. The firstborn of Rachel, Benjamin, was the second and the last of Rachel. Jacob said, "Bring these boys before me, and I want to confer a blessing on them." And he laid his hands on them, and Joseph tried to switch them around. He said, no, this is the way I've got it. I'm going to cross my hands. "Let my name be named. They will be like my own sons. They will be like my very own sons, just like Reuben and Simeon are my sons, just like my firstborn sons." So he laid his name and pronounced the blessings that had gone all the way back to Abraham through Isaac and then to him. And these blessings would go on these two individuals. All the blessings that you find from the time of Genesis 12 would be borne out through history by the descendants of this individual. And so when you combine that with a statement of the last days and what is going to happen to all of his sons in the last days, you have a clue that even though the information is slight and it only comprises a couple of chapters after you get past Joseph and Jacob and Israel, you have a clue as to the rest of these sons, as to what might happen to them. And the firstborn of all of them was Reuben. And so in verse 3, we get to Reuben and the pronouncement, not necessarily a blessing, but just a pronouncement of the future as to what would happen to Reuben. "Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might in the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power." Now, the French people are noted for a lot of things. A lot of things other than just wine and cheese. They have been an incredible people through history. They have overcome an incredible amount, and they have had some incredible achievements through life. I mean, just incredible, incredible things. The French language for many, many years, up until probably about the latter part of the 20th century, was the international language of diplomacy. It's what diplomats spoke, thus fulfilling apparently this statement, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power. Diplomats were supposed to be nice to each other. Countries would have their consulates in other countries, and whenever they would speak, whatever it would be, whether it would be the Russian embassy in China or the British embassy in Hong Kong or whatever it was, the language that those diplomats spoke and that they communicated with was oftentimes the French language. And it's still one of the greatest languages in the world in terms of number of people spoken. Just off the top of my head, I would say probably English is more universal now than any. Then after that, maybe Chinese of one sort or another. After that point, Spanish most definitely in terms of the number of people who speak it. And then right after that, French. It used to be that French in the entire civilized world was the language that was spoken by many people. I'm looking for some notes that I don't know what happened to them. Oh, well, maybe they're here somewhere. Anyway, we'll get into that in just a bit. The beginning of strength. Now, we don't read in our history books today about the French colonizing much of the world, but they did at first. They did at first. They explored and tried to colonize not where Portugal and Spain went, which basically was Central and South America, and they kind of carved up a little bit of the Caribbean. The French got a little bit of the Caribbean. The French got a little bit of Canada. The French got vast portions of Southeast Asia and some parts of Africa. So they did their part, but they didn't stay very long. And they used to have outposts in which you would find, remember, the French Foreign Legion was an elite corps of militia that would guard the interests of the French in places like the Sahara Desert and places in northern Africa. And they settled some parts of other parts of Africa, but they didn't have that staying power. So when Israel or when Jacob said, "My might in the beginning of my strength," it seems to indicate from a prophetic standpoint that the descendants of Reuben would be among some of the first on the scene, like they were in Canada. And it basically became a part of the Commonwealth of Great Britain later on. Parts of the great northwest of our country, South Dakota and Montana and Oregon, all of these places were kind of found initially first by French fur trappers. But they never had the staying power to be able to develop it. They had this vast portion of the United States that we bought from France for 3 pennies an acre called the Louisiana Purchase that was owned by the French. And we purchased it in 1803, and that helped Napoleon for a short while in his grandiose schemes of expansionism all the way to the point of trying to conquer Russia, which we know did not happen. Amazing, they have gone to Africa, Indochina, Vietnam. Let's turn to a companion scripture in Deuteronomy chapter 33. This is also a chapter that details these sons. Deuteronomy chapter 33, and maybe you've missed that, maybe you've gotten it before, but in Deuteronomy 33, it mentions Reuben in verse 6, and I'll mention this, that I studied France first or extensively when I was in Ambassador College in our geography class, and we had to kind of, in each country we studied, we have to draw a map of that country. Pretty simple to copy a map, but then we'd also have to learn about everything that we could about the facts of the nation. At that time, the population of France was about 60 million, and today it's about 66 million. In that same time period, we've probably added 100 million in our country. When you think about it, that's incredible. We've had incredible growth. We're almost 300 million. I remember going to the Census Bureau in Washington, D.C. in the early 70s and looking at the count of our population, because they'd have it, you know, just clicking all the time, and it was like 199,000 or so at that particular time. We're 100 million more than we used to be around that period of time. Maybe it was late 60s, 70s, but at any rate, population of France has remained basically unchanged, hasn't grown that much. And in fact, you could probably turn to the growth in the population has come from the non-indigent Muslim population, which now comprises about 7.5%. There are virtually none of them at the time of the 1970s when I was studying geography. But about 7.5% of the population of France now is people from Tunisia and from Syria and from other portions of the Middle East. But the one thing they have in common is Islam, and that's where they're from. But in Deuteronomy 33 in verse 6, it says, "Let Reuben live and not die." Yes, France is still a spectacular nation today, really great accomplishments. You'll be amazed at some of the things that they have done there. And when you think and reflect back at what the firstborn of Jacob has done, it really is incredible. But it says, italicized, nor, which is not a part of the script, let his men be few. It could sustain population growth, but the population growth of France, like some of the other nations of Europe, has slowed to a crawl, or else it's kind of reverse. The population is aging. They're not replacing their population. That certainly is one of the things that sociologists look to in terms of a nation's decline. If your population is not growing, you're not going to be able to replace your workers. You're not going to have enough people to replace in various positions as time goes on. In a generation or two, you could become, you know, a substandard nation. You're not going to continue being an innovator. You're not going to continue being the great nation that you are. Let his men be few. But let's go back a little bit earlier to Genesis chapter 29, which details the birth of Reuben, the firstborn, and see what happened then. It's a fascinating story, and maybe it can help you to understand that, you know, first of all, you'd have to accept that they are the descendants, the French are the descendants of Reuben. So you have to kind of take a leap of faith there, along with some of the proof in Genesis 49 and Deuteronomy 33. So if you accept that, then so far, so good. If you're not, then the rest of the sermon is kind of worthless. But it may be worthless anyway, for all I know. But anyhow, going back to Genesis chapter 29, you find that here's the introduction. Isaac didn't want his son to marry any of the women from around his area, so he sent him off to his home area, and he came in contact with Laban and found his first true love, love at first sight, Rachel, just an incredibly beautiful woman. And his father-in-law tricked him because Rachel was the youngest, and in his family, Laban wanted to get the oldest daughter married off first, so he kind of cunningly devised this trickery. We won't go into it. You can read the rest of yourself in the chapter. So he's stuck. He's got both sisters. You know, not a great situation by any means. And so it was obvious who he loved the most, and God allowed all this to happen. It was not right. It's not appropriate, but it's the way that families developed in, I don't know if this would be the copper age or the iron ore age, as the archaeologists would call it in the development, but there were not that many people living on earth, and this is the way you amassed wealth and power, by having big families and lots of sons, and in some cases lots of wives. So it wasn't out of common place, it wasn't out of common with the territory in the area, but it certainly wasn't God's way, and it wasn't God's will for this to be done. But nonetheless, God doesn't just intervene in every single situation in people's lives, a good lesson for all of us, and say, wait a minute, you can't do that. You shouldn't do that. Better back off. That's not the way it operates. Jacob had been taught, he had been trained, and yet here is the weakness. God allowed the weakness. God allowed all the results as a result of the weakness. So that's enough of the explanation that we need there. So in verse 23, we read, "Now it came to pass in the evening that he took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to Jacob, and he went into her." You know, kind of very respectful language for their consummation of their marriage, right? But Jacob is tricked. So it came to pass in the morning, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, what is this you have done? Was it not for Rachel that I've served you? Why then have you deceived me? Oh, it's not done so in our country to give the younger before the firstborn, you know, fulfill her week, now I'll give you the younger one, so on and so forth. So we have this strange situation. Now we've got two wives and one man. So despite all of that, in verse 31, it says, when the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, he opened her womb, and Rachel was barren. So Leah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Reuben. For she said, the Lord has surely looked on my affliction. Now, therefore, my husband will love me. That's the thinking, the bond, you know, the husband, the wife, the child, you know, he'll finally love me. But he still loved Rachel more. And so, but they still kept acting as husband, wife, and wife. And one thing led to another. She conceived again and bore a son, because the Lord has heard that I am unloved. He has therefore given me this son also, and he called his name Simeon. You need kind of an abacus or a calculator to keep track of things from now on. But she conceived again and bore a son. Now this time my husband will become attached to me, because I've borne him three sons. Therefore his name was called Levi. And so Levi then became the priesthood in the government of God. And they were the descendants. And Levi and Simeon, who the Bible later on says in Genesis 49 were instruments of cruelty. They were not given anything except, along with Judah, to be scattered in all the tribes of Israel. And so I'm not saying that everybody has the last name of Levi as Simeon or from that tribe, but maybe some of them are. Certainly wouldn't be very, very surprising. Then she conceived again and bore a son and said, now we'll praise the Lord. Therefore, she called his name Judah. Then she stopped bearing, at least for a little while. So these three brothers are born. Then we move on to Genesis 30. And we see some of these sins that God allowed. Now, Reuben was growing up. It doesn't say what his age was. He could be 12, he could be 14, he could have been 10, but he was old enough to wander into the wheat fields and gather fruit. And so imagine if you're in this situation where you've got two wives who are sisters, and they each have servants, handmaidens, and they become, you know, basically extra wives that Jacob has. So he had, you know, whatever problems anybody has in a marriage, he had it fourfold at this point. But Reuben went into the days of the wheat harvest, found mandrakes in the field, and brought them to his mother Leah. Admittedly, this all from now on here is very strange to our Western ears and to our society. And the bargaining that went on in this particular case is kind of mind-boggling and strange. Let's not doubt it, but it's in the Bible. Then Rachel said to Leah, that's her sister, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. Now, Brent, you know, I don't know how old Reuben was, if he's just a little kid at this point. The Bible doesn't say. But being exposed to all of this in some way or another in this family has got to kind of warp your thinking. Does it not? I mean, would it not be kind of odd and strange? But she said to her, is it a small matter that you have taken away my husband? Now, she regarded him more as her husband than she thought that her sister should regard her, because she had children. So there is more of a bond there than her mind. And she's telling her sister, you've stolen my husband. So, well, that was her thinking. Would you take away my son's mandrakes also? And Rachel said, and getting a little weirder now, therefore he will lie with you tonight for your son's mandrakes. Well, so you got a bargaining that is taking place. So when Jacob came out of the field in the evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, you must come in to me, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes. And he lay with her that night. This is kind of almost getting to the point of being disgusting, but it's in the Bible. And it's what I'm laying the groundwork so that you can understand the environment that this firstborn son, older now than his brothers, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, was exposed to. So this kind of shuffling between the tents, so to speak, had to have, at least in my view, some effect. Now we go to how this all came out in terms of how it affected and how it was manifested in the life of Reuben in chapter 35. And we'll begin here in verse 22. Wasn't getting it. And neither is this. Okay. Thought we were there. Let's see. It worked this morning. I don't know what happened here, but it worked this morning. So, okay, here it is. Yes, it is 22. All right. That's getting blind. Chapter 35, verse 22. And it happened when Israel dwelt in that land that Reuben, now apparently a grown man of some age, went in and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine. You know, another, yet another wife. And Israel heard about it. The rest of the family heard about this depravity. And this, these are things that God allowed to happen. And so we go to Genesis chapter 49, where we had left off at one point. And let's pick up the story, because this is definitely not a blessing, but this is a renouncing of what had happened. The die had been cast, and instead of repentance over that, apparently there wasn't. The attitude was ingrained. Verse 4 also says of Reuben, unstable as water, you shall not excel. And that is why you see, I think, because of the pronouncement of this prophecy, you see in history some of these weird, strange, quirky things that have happened throughout the time of the modern nation of France, going back to the Middle Ages and all the way up to the present time, where you know you have this mixed bag of great and wonderful beginnings and yet not the ability to follow through and excel. This is not a, well, I hope this is not going to turn into a sermon where we're not going to put it on the internet again like last week. This is not a condemnation of the French people. The French people, especially if you speak French and are in France, are wonderful people, and the land is absolutely beautiful. And they have some of the greatest wine, of course, in the world. They do a lot of things right, and they are so grateful for the sacrifice made by America in two world wars. And they have been incredibly thankful, and the graveyards that they maintain near Normandy with all of the Allied soldiers, tens of thousands of them buried, and reverentially thought of as being what saved France and what saved the continent. They understand that, and they recognize it. There is some quirkiness associated with the French, because that is the parody in modern entertainment of the French themselves. I mean, I'm not making this up, and I'm not casting aspersions, but you know, whether it's the Pink Panther, the actor that is portraying a French detective is, you know, the inspector that is clumsy and, you know, just kind of clumsy and befuddled and everything. But that's kind of the parody. I'm not saying that that is. I'm just saying that sometimes a parody or a generalization exists for a certain purpose. So my friend Bill Murphy, who is Scottish, in the late 60s is in France and doesn't know much French. And he's not getting around really well very much in the French underground in Paris. And he's, you know, backing up a line or a queue, as they say in France, because he didn't have the right tokens for the train, the underground train. And in his best French, in trying to explain himself to the people that are yelling at him and screaming at him because he's holding everything up, he says in his most perfect French, could you please tell me the name of your umbrella? Silence. I don't know what it is in French, but silence. That, okay, I guess we got to give this guy a break because he doesn't know what he's doing. It was funny when Bill told it, even funnier than when I tell it. But anyway, but incredible things that the French are known for. Certainly their cuisine. if you get rid of the snails. I just can't go with that one. I'm just not gonna be eating snails. The arts, they have been a first, and they have been very excellent. The Louvre in Paris holds some of the world's great treasures, probably the most famous art museum in the world, and it kind of helps us to understand the fulfillment of prophecy in the first part of what God pronounced on these people at the end of the age. Fashion. You know, all of the top fashion, whether you like it or not or whatever, everything, all the standards are set in Paris, and it comes over to London and New York, and it kind of, but, you know, all the trends, and a lot of it is horrible, of course, but, you know, some of those models could, you know, eat a cracker every now and then, right? So, but ballet, the French and Impressionist artists became some of the most famous in all the world, Renoir and others. The sciences, Madame Curie, and incredible discoveries in France. There are some things that they do better than we do here. And there's some things technically that they are much better and further advanced than we are, like kind of nuclear power, where we've kind of shut it all down. That's one of the largest generators of electricity in France, and they've been able to make it work, and they've been able to make it safe. They also developed the international units of measurement, which we hate in the English world. Yeah, meters, centimeters. What are these things? Yeah, what's that? Let's see. You're the second. You've got your second shot into a par four. It's 156 meters. What's that? I have no idea how far that is. But that's what they use in European golf tournaments, and you have to be able to figure that out in terms of yards. Now, recently, three Americans were able to prevent a terrorist attack. Remember, on one of the French trains. Not just any train, but their train system is probably the best in the world, and certainly one of the best, if not the best, in Europe, and the fastest. Now, if you get on Amtrak, we're really proud of Amtrak, whoopee, you can get on Amtrak in Dallas, Texas, and it is a short ride to Tucson of only about 37 hours. It's about how long it takes to get here. I have some people that used to work for the railroad here. Our railroads kind of are not so great in comparison, at least the transportation, the passenger transportation. Their trains go well over 200 miles an hour, and it crisscrosses all through France. It's incredible, and they do a great job. Also, probably not surprising, they were the leaders in the development of the hot air balloon. And you didn't know that, did you? So, but incredible stuff. Aircraft. Their Mirage jet plane was so advanced that in the 1960s, the Israelis were able to infiltrate their aircraft plant, take photographs of the plans of the French Mirage, and build the exact duplicate in Israel, long before we started giving them F-15s and whatever else we started giving them. They built that plane from the French plans. They built the exact same jet because at that particular time, people were wary of selling arms to them. They also developed, along with Britain, the Concorde. So the French have done some incredible things. Now, in Genesis chapter 37, we see that Joseph is born. He's the first son of Jacob and Rachel, and he's loved more than all his other brothers. Now, that wouldn't cause a problem anywhere, would it, if you've got 11 other sons or 10 other at the time, and Benjamin hadn't been born yet? Probably wouldn't create any animosity or jealousy if your father showered you with all kinds of gifts because you were the firstborn of his true love of Rachel, who had not been able to have children for a long time, and yet finally she did. Verse 3, now Israel, that is Jacob, loved Joseph more than all his children, more than all. And you don't hide that. You can't hide that in a big family. You can't hide it at all. And certainly one of the worst mistakes that a parent can make is playing favorites. Because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a tunic of many colors. Now, in the early 1970s, there was a musical that became a Broadway hit, and it was entitled Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, highlighting all the things that Joseph is mentioned as being famous for. I never saw the musical. I've heard some of the music. Not too bad. But a lot of you probably think that that coat of many colors, as I did when I was a little kid in Sunday school in Thurmont, Maryland, as it was portrayed in our Sunday school lesson, was a striped robe-type garment with stripes of different colors all over it. And you'd be wrong. Do you know what it actually was? The thing that is most similar that you would be familiar with was the Scottish tartan. Yeah, that's right. The Scottish tartan. It wasn't flowing stripes. Because only in the tartan do you incorporate and do you have any record in history of it being a similar design of many colors being incorporated. Now, how do I know that for an absolute fact? I don't. I just made it up. I was hoping I could be convincing enough that you guys would kind of buy into it, but I'm just lending you another idea as to what it was. Now, the Buchanan tartan is probably the ugliest of all tartans because it's got so many colors, and it's got orange and yellow and red and blue and green, and it's got all these colors, but to me, it's not all that beautiful a tartan. There are other tartans that I like. But apparently, according to the historians that I have talked to, the more colors in the clan's tartan, the more important or the higher up the echelon or ranking of that particular clan. So that was basically the rule. If you had two colors, like the Black Stuart, then maybe not so prominent a clan. But this was a coat of many colors. Probably the Buchanan tartan, when you get down to it, is probably the Buchanan blood goes back to that particular time. There's hardly any doubt. I mean, what tartan has more colors? But I don't know positively. I really don't know at all. Okay, so, but just giving you another viewpoint as to what it could have been. So you know the rest of the story. When his brother saw him, they diabolically plotted to kill him. And this horrible thing, he came in verse 5, he had a dream, he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. I don't know why, but here's the dream. Please hear the dream which I have dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright, and indeed your sheaf stood all around and bowed down to the sheaf. This wasn't a dream like Nebuchadnezzar's dream that was hard to understand. They got it. You're telling us we're going to bow down to you? It was a prophetic dream, though. Shall you reign over us? Verse 8. Then he dreamed still another dream, and he told it to his brothers. He said, look, I've dreamed another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me. So he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream? Again, didn't take a Daniel to interpret this. Shall your mother and I and all your brothers bow down to you? Are you kidding me? And so his brothers envied him. Aha. But this stuck with Jacob. This stuck with him. He remembered it. It stayed with him. And so his brothers began to be more and more hostile. And the rest of the chapter details how he comes along. They see him from afar off. They despise him. Which shows, again, the family structure is totally askew and chaotic. Because why would you hate your brother, even if he was a little bit obnoxious in a real family? So they decide to kill him. But guess what? Verse 22, Reuben said to them, shed no blood. Let's cast him into the pit instead. He won't be able to get out. Throw him in there. In his own mind, he's going to come back and save him. Historically, There is no denying the fact that if you've accepted so far that Reuben is the modern-day equivalent of the French people, there is absolutely no mistaking the fact that Reuben has been a very gracious older brother to the United States of America. And it is the French people who made and donated at the beginning of the 20th century the Statue of Liberty. And that statue has been viewed by every single lawful immigrant that came in the great wave of immigration from the early 1900s to the early 1920s of our nation, which all of them looking to it recognized that that was the signature of a different land, and that there was a beacon of a flame that showed liberty for all the tired, the poor, and the wretched that would come to these shores. And it has provided hope. What an incredible, it is the greatest symbol of American freedom in our nation today from a symbolic standpoint, and has been for well over 100 years. The French gave that to us. We also benefited from the aforementioned Louisiana Purchase, which made us automatically more than double in size as a nation, and then just continued on and on from there. In addition to that, the French were our friends and allies in our war against our other common enemy at that time, Great Britain. And they helped us and they saved us. And it was with the channels of diplomacy that were opened up with Benjamin Franklin and James Mason and others who went to the French. And this was prior to the demise of Napoleon, which happened in 1815, by the way. But it was prior to this time that the French reached out as an older brother to help us. Now, in this case, Reuben was not able to save his youngest brother, half-brother, different mother. But he was very upset about it. And you know the story and how God allowed it and why he allowed it and Joseph going to Egypt and everything that he went through. 1 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 18, you see in history, in ancient biblical history from the time of the Exodus, you see this affiliation that stayed true to form with the closeness of the French, well, the closeness of the Reubenites and the Manassites. 1 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 18. And then you'll find many references to Reuben, probably I think more references in the book of Joshua to Reuben than any others, because Reuben, Gad, we think Switzerland is Gad, by the way, which is next door to modern-day France. Reuben, Gad, and one half tribe of the tribe of Manasseh petitioned Moses to stay on the land of the east of Jordan. You'll remember that story in the book of Joshua. And Moses told them, and Joshua warned them as well, that if anything happens to this nation, you'd better not allow the limitation of staying over on this side of the Jordan limit your ability to come fight for your brothers and your other tribes. And they swore that they would not let that happen. And in fact, one of the great misunderstandings in the book of Joshua is this time in which, as you'll read through it, you'll find that Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh were so desirous of keeping that covenant and not breaking it with the other tribes that they built an altar there that would recognize their commitment to the rest of the tribes. And of course, that was all misinterpreted through rumor and innuendo, and they thought they were building a false, idolatrous idol, and they're ready to go wipe them out because of that. The cooler heads prevailed, and they were able to explain it. But in 1 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 18, we read, Oh, 2 Chronicles, no wonder. 1 Chronicles 5 and verse 18. The sons of Reuben, the Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh had 44,760 valiant men, able to bear shield and sword, to shoot with the bow, and skillful in war, who went to war. And they made war with the Hagarites, Jetur, Naphish, and Nodab. And they were helped against them, and the Hagarites delivered into their hand, and all who were with them, for they cried out to God in the battle, and he heeded their prayer, because he put their trust in them. Verse 23, so the children of the half-tribe of Manasseh dwelt in the land. The half-tribe of Manasseh. Now, I don't know where these folks ever got separated. The Bible is not really complete on that. The half-tribe of Manasseh. We believe Manasseh is the United States of America. And as I've said before, England was wrought with civil wars in the 15, 16s, and 1700s before this mass exodus began. And once it began, they stopped having civil wars. They no longer had the Hundred Years' War, the War of the Roses, etc., etc. They stopped having civil wars in England, and then about 70 or 80 years after we were formed, we had a civil war. It was kind of bound to happen. And the country is still divided, north and south. You have a difference in people, right? North and south in the United States. And there's been a lot of migration back and forth from that time, but it is kind of just an interesting thing. It has nothing to do with France, but except that half of the tribe of Manasseh was more aligned with France, and has been. I'm just making the point that there has always been this special relationship, even from the time when they were just two people, and it seems to have existed all the way through history, in one way or another, to the point to where we've repaid the favor a couple of times, right, in world wars and come to the aid of the French. World War II, World War I, we kind of replaced the French in Vietnam. They were there, they left, we came in. We kind of both failed. Kind of detailed in the Mel Gibson movie, We Were Soldiers. It touches on that a little bit at the beginning of that movie. So why terror, and why this horrible terrorist attack in France, where over 160 about people were killed, including the seven who, exploded themselves. Thankfully, they are able to kill themselves in the process, at least some of them. Why this happening in France? Well, you'll remember this satirical magazine making fun of the Prophet Muhammad last year, and the terrorists that came into that particular publishing house and mowed them down with submachine guns. And now this has happened. A terrorist attack was prevented on the exquisite train lines of France by three Americans, coincidentally, not too long ago, or else there would have been carnage on that high-speed train. 4.7 Muslims, or 7.5% of the population, live in France today, one of the greater concentrations of Muslims in Europe today. Maybe, though, it's because it's a part of Israel, and even though the combatants don't know it, they're against anything of the West. The French have colonized Northern Africa, Tunisia, parts of other parts of the world. So where does it all lead? The French people are a part of Europe. They are on the continent of Europe. They do not even know, many of them, that they have a common ancestry with their brothers across the Channel in Great Britain, their brothers across the Atlantic, or other brothers that they have scattered around northwestern Europe, in Finland and in Denmark and in Norway and in Sweden and all of these other nations. We are in the very beginning stages, as you probably surmised, of what is mentioned in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40. There has not been a response to some of these things, like happened during the Middle Ages or what happened in 632 at the Battle of Tours between the French and Muslim at that time, where the Muslim faith and people were expelled from Europe. And now there is incredible migration from Syria and from the civil wars of the Middle East into northwestern Europe, especially Germany, and not so much in eastern Europe, because they realize that it is going to change their culture dynamically. And in Hungary, they have erected fences and kept those people out. Some of them come into the countries, come into those host countries. They never assimilate. They never become part of that nation. They're different. There's no doubt that they're different in a philosophical way, as well as, in terms of the indigent people of Europe, they're not the same racially. They're just not that one's good or bad. It's just that they're not the same, and they don't assimilate. Daniel 11 in verse 40 is a verse that we could not have understood in a way that we may today, back in 1971 when I first came into the church. But there's a reason for this. It's talking about the king of the north attacking the king of the south. And we don't have a king of the south, although we have a nation that calls itself ISIS, which means an Islamic state. It doesn't really appear to be a state yet. It's a terrorist organization. It controls or occupies some territory, but it's not unified. It's not loved universally in the Islamic world. But that time of unification appears to be coming in the future. We don't know when. But the king of the south is going to attack somehow, some means, in some ways. It could be attacks of terrorism. We don't know. But there will be a response in the future, a response that is swift and dramatic and will lead the world to war. He shall come at him with a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and overwhelm them and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. That would be the areas just to the east of Jerusalem and to the south. All of those areas appear to escape. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. So it'll be kind of surrounded. And it's going to overtake. So if he's going to overtake all of those countries, there's got to be a reason. The reason in my mind right now is, and this is pure speculation, is that if he's going to surround all of those areas, it would be because there's a unification of Islam in all of those countries that he's going to attack against and he's going to come back against. So only time will tell. But in the midst of this, are the French people who are in the belly of the beast, because the beast and the false prophet are going to arise out of Europe. That much we know from Revelation 12 and 13. And back a couple of pages in the book of Daniel in chapter 8, this prophecy actually is kind of filling in some of the details of what is going to happen. It says in verse 22, "As for the broken horn and the horn that stood up in his place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not without its power. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressions have reached their fullness, a king shall arise having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power." He's going to have help, as we know. "He shall destroy fearfully, he shall prosper and thrive, he shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people." That's detailed in Revelation 11, or chapter 10 as well. "Through his cunning he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule, and he shall exalt himself in his heart, and he shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes." And that's in Revelation 19, it shows that Christ is going to return. This means to me, with all of this happening and this terror attack as a kind of a shot over the bow from a prophetic standpoint, that more and more and worse things are going to happen. Terry and I were talking about this at dinner last night. You know, we had, when our kids were little, we had the bombing of our Marine barracks in Lebanon. I think it was Lebanon at the time. You know, a bunch of Marines died, 230 or so. We've had other things that have happened, but That was against the military, and this is against civilians. We have not really had anything like this. When we were young parents, we didn't have anything like this that we could compare it to, you know, going back to 9/11, multiple thousands of deaths of civilians, and now this. It's going to be a fact of life as time goes on, and it's got to galvanize people to action. It's got to move the ball forward from a prophetic sense. Revelation, or Romans chapter 11 says something very encouraging, though, and I'll leave you with this. To me, this means that the gospel, which this particular chapter speaks about, the gospel message, the good news, from a 40,000 viewpoint, has got to be known by all of Israel at some point. And I don't think an adequate message has been given in this nation. I don't think in Western Europe an adequate message has been given. But I think it's coming. And how it is conveyed to them, I'm not exactly sure. And we'll all probably wonder about that. But there is coming a time where it says in verse 26, "So all Israel will be saved, as it is written." In a greater sense, Israel includes all of the sons of Jacob. They're all a part of Israel because they're under the banner of Israel, because his name was changed from Israel, and they're all his sons. In the prophetic sense, when we see Israel, it often means simply the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh. And Jacob, Joseph, Israel are all mentioned, and they're all basically the same, unless you see Ephraim and Manasseh mentioned separately, as sometimes you do in the minor prophets. Matthew 24 and verse 14 says, "This gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all nations, and then the end shall come." That gospel will be preached among the sons of Reuben, and some of them will respond.